Meet Bonnie. She has Hashimoto's, and her biggest complaints were brain fog, fatigue, and respiratory issues. I met Bonnie in my Thyroid Mystery Self program, and we started to address all of her immune triggers. She's been wondering if mold has been an issue for her in the past, but didn't really know where to start. I knew exactly where we needed to look so that we could get to the bottom of her thyroid mystery and her immune triggers.
Every year, thousands of people are told there's no explanation for their health concerns and no way to fix them. They feel frustrated, undermined, and lost. I know, because that was me before I figured out the actual causes and reclaimed my health. Now, I help others do the same. I'm Ina Toppler, and this is Health Mystery Solved.
We just heard about all of the issues that Bonnie was dealing with, and coming back on the show to talk so much more about this is Jason Earle. He is an indoor air quality crusader. He is also the founder and CEO of 1-800-GOT-MOLD, as well as Mycolab USA, and he is the creator of the Got Mold Test Kit. Jason, I am so excited to have you back. Welcome back to Thyroid Mystery Solved, Hypothyroid and Hashimoto's Revealed.
It's so good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, it's not news that mold exposure is not healthy for any of us, right? But what a lot of people don't realize is that specifically for Hashimoto's and other autoimmune diseases as well, but in general, Hashimoto's and thyroid issues, mold can really be a big immune trigger. And I know there's so much that we're going to unpack about this today. But just to make sure that everyone's on the same page, when we think about mold, you know, people think, okay, well, I'm not around mold. I'm not seeing mold. But what are some ways that people can actually be exposed to it? Because it's a lot more than people realize.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So mold exposure is somewhat complex. It could be subtle. It could be completely undetectable, quite frankly, especially when you start looking at food, which is an under-recognized route of exposure. So most people think about mold in the building as something that you either see or smell or feel, which is generally what we suggest people do, is sort of tune into their senses. And if you see something, smell something, or feel something, do something. But the evidence is mounting that we have a real problem with our food supply, especially when it comes to imported grains. This 2018 study found that 60-80% of our imported grains are contaminated with mycotoxins. And mycotoxins are the poisons that molds produce to compete with one another. And so this is happening in more than just our imported grains. It's also happening with nuts, seeds, spices, and also domestically. It happens anytime food is mishandled, if the climate control is not being controlled well. And then also when it comes to conventional meat and dairy, because these animals are being fed food they don't normally eat in nature, right? They're being fed grains, which are not human grade. Well, what is it that makes them not human grade? They're first of all being stored in suboptimal conditions. And then, of course, many times they're already contaminated. And so they don't make the cut for humans. But we, being at the top of the food chain, just like mercury rises through the food chain, through little fish to the big fish and then to us, so too do mycotoxins, because they are heat resistant. You cannot cook them out. And so they end up in our food supply. And then they concentrate in us because they're lipophilic, meaning they get stored in our fat cells. And then they're also hydrophobic, which means that they don't excrete well in urine. They don't dissolve into water. So there's a lot of factors there that ultimately make mold exposure through food a really common problem. And that, by the way, happens to be what is mostly showing up in mycotoxin urine panels, which are very popular these days.
Yeah. And just for people who may not be familiar, what is a mycotoxin urine panel? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. It's one of the only tools that are available right now for functional and integrative practitioners. So basically, it's a urine sample, and they look for the metabolites or the byproducts of mold's digestive process, and also the mycotoxins that it produces. So there are actually a few different. There's ones called oat panels, and then there's another one called that are mycotoxin panels. And so it's focusing on the mycotoxin panels. They're looking for the sort of the primary violators, if you will. And unfortunately, that oftentimes triggers a response which leads to expensive inspections and remediation that may or may not be necessary in the home. And oftentimes people skip over the most important exposure, which is really their pantry and restaurants. So this is the real kick in the pants that most people don't want to hear, is that when you're eating out, unless it says organic, it isn't. And usually anything that's made with the processed grains, refined carbohydrates, is generally going to have an international component. And so that's where we get most of our exposures from, in my research and in my professional opinion. So the panels are limited to these sort of primary violators. But the other thing that's important to note is that mycotoxin producing molds account for about 100 species out of 100,000. So what that means is that mold sickness, let me back up, to suggest that only those 100 molds are what causes all mold-related illness, and to the exclusion of 99,900, defies logic. So there's other factors when it comes to mold exposure, especially when it comes to our buildings. The mold that grows in our buildings produces lots of other chemicals that don't show up in these mycotoxin urine panels.
Okay. So that's very, very helpful to know, because there are people, and depending on where you are on your journey, you know, some people who maybe have gone the functional medicine route and maybe have seen providers, and you're trying to look into your triggers. And if you're wondering if mold is an issue, you may have had a mycotoxin test done. And as Jason is saying, you know, as helpful as it can be, it's really only accounting for the small part, and it's more of the food part even. And I think it's so interesting what you're saying, Jason. We're going to get into more of this as we talk today, that a lot of times if people have high mycotoxins in that urine panel, it ends up going into, okay, well, where's the mold exposure? A lot of people don't think of it from a food perspective, and they say, okay, it must be something in my home. And depending on who then you bring in that does the inspection and then further remediation, you know, it's, the field is not very regulated, right? And so, you know, sometimes, you know, you get right in answers, but then other times, you know, there may be walls being opened up and things being looked at. And not to say that that's not necessary, right? But in some situations, like you said, if you're not looking at the food component, which is where a lot of it could be coming from, it can potentially create a lot of unnecessary expenses, right? And excavation, really.
Yeah, and I should point out that false positives, or actually when data is misinterpreted in a way that it lends itself to, like, oh well, this is that you get a high mycotoxin in your panel, you must have mold in your home. That is a conflation. In other words, those are two different ideas being mashed up together, where you've got this idea that mold grows in buildings, and mold produces mycotoxins. So if I've got mold in my urine, if I've got mycotoxins in my urine, I must have mold in my building. That's fundamentally not true. But when your provider suggests that, because they may not be aware of the food exposures, then you end up on a wild goose chase. And so that I would argue is a combination of sort of like a false positive. If the data is misinterpreted, then it really ends up being a false positive. And so you end up going down rabbit holes. It's important to realize that when it comes to this, you really have to you have to be your own advocate in many ways. You have to do your own research. Listening to podcasts like this is very important. But you know, when it comes down to the mycotoxin exposures and then people immediately going to an inspection, the other problem is that oftentimes the provider will recommend an inspector who they work with that's very focused on the mycotoxins also. And then they often use a test called ERMI, which stands for Environmental Relative Moldiness Index. And it's a dust test. It's actually not a test. It's a research tool that was developed 20 years ago by an EPA staffer. And it's been used by a lot of practitioners because it seems to have a very high sensitivity. Well, the problem is that it actually has way too high of a sensitivity. And it actually was always high. I mean, when I say always, I mean 95% of the time it's high, even in buildings that don't have any history of water damage. And through my inspection company, I've been behind hundreds of these high tests, high readings, and I've been only able to verify conditions in the building that reflected what the test found in about 10% of cases. So you end up with, if you jump from data point to data point, and you have a high mycotoxin panel, and then you go into your house and you do an ERMI test, whoa, you must have a problem, because the mycotoxins are high. Almost everybody, by the way, is high. Almost everybody, unless you've got detox pathway issues, which is very common also. But if you have high mycotoxin reading in your urine and then you have a high ERMI in your house, that's enough to scare you into just about anything. That leads to really outrageous remediations that are oftentimes unnecessary. So rewinding that and getting focused on the primary exposure that leads to a high urine panel is really, really important because it can save you enormous amounts of money and also peace of mind. So, but getting back to, you know, I look at this as mold-related illness is really about air, food, and attitude. You know, you can't really get better until you believe you can get better. So that's where the attitude piece comes in. But you can't look at mold exclusively with buildings. Although building-related mold is a major issue. When it comes to thyroid, you have to look at them in totality. You have to look at the whole package.
We'll talk about building mold in a second, but just going back to food, what you're saying is that it's the international grains and things that aren't organic and then the conventionally produced dairy and meat. So what recommendations do you have for people who may have high mycotoxins or suspect there could be an issue and they want to look at the food? Do you recommend then that they go grain-free or is it changing the types of grains they eat?
Yes. Yeah. No, good. Great question. So it's a no sugar, no grains diet. So it looks a lot like keto, but with also a focus on making sure that any of the meats and dairy that you consume is organic, local, grass fed, pastured, et cetera. So really it becomes sort of it's a whole foods diet, a true whole foods diet. You know, the organic part when it comes to veggies and stuff like that, it's important for lots of other reasons, right? Like you don't need to worry about mold when it comes to that stuff. But it ends up being, you're also going to avoid things like peanut butter and applesauce, unless you make your own tomato sauce. Even if you think about the way these tomatoes and apples are selected for sauces, they're probably the uglies, you know, they're probably already out on their way out. And there's no way that they're carving out all of the nasty parts before they throw that in the bin, which sits there for a few more days before it gets processed. So you have to eliminate these kinds of obvious sources. Also, cured meats tend to be a problem because the curing process often involves spices that can be contaminated coming from developing countries. So cleaning up your diet has to do with, you know, just being very aware of the fact that anything that's been stored for any length of time, anything that comes in a box, a bag, anything that's processed like a powder, where the point of origination is a question mark. These are the things that you want to avoid. And then of course, you know, like I said, restaurants are a major problem. And so, you know, when you're eating out, you have to make sure that you're eating, you know, organic, local, grass fed. And that means the burger might be fine, but the bun might not be. And so, you know, it is a challenge. For those of you who eat keto already, and who've been through this adjustment phase, it will require you taking it up a notch. Which means that you then go to the, you know, like I said, local seasonal grass-fed pastured meats and dairy, which is crucial because again, the dairy, you know, you're passing all that stuff through in the fats. And so all that stuff comes through beautifully and then we retain it. And that's really where I think a lot of this is coming from. You know, mold in food and mold in air, if you happen to have the double whammy, as many of us do, if you've got a problem in your house and we're all eating the same kind of stuff, we're all eating from the same trough, if you will, no pun intended. You know, when you look at the way that these things potentially amplify each other, it's no wonder that, you know, people refer to mold as sort of like kryptonite, right? Because you're getting mycotoxins tend to operate mostly on organ systems. And then indoor air quality related exposures tend to affect you more on a cognitive basis, brain fog, emotional dysregulation, fatigue, things like that. And so oftentimes people present with both symptoms, you know, gut related issues, organ related issues, and then also the cognitive stuff. And then, of course, you know, it also presents in many cases as, you know, surfacing of autoimmune diseases like the ones we're talking about today.
Now, do you feel that if someone, let's say, is maybe just starting their journey and they're worried about mycotoxins and exposure to food and they eliminate the grains and they eliminate all of the things that can have mycotoxins in them, and as they do that, they then work on their detox pathways and they support their methylation and they do all of the things as they go through their journey, do you think that they would at some point be able to handle some of those grains because if the detox pathways are working, that their body can process it? Or is it something where everyone has their own threshold?
I think it's a very personal thing. I think all of these things are so bio-individual. You know, a lot of times people say that they just feel better eating that way anyway. And once you've sort of gotten your diet clean, you know, it becomes less and less appealing also. you start to wade back into those waters, and you start to go, wait, why did I do that? You know, like, I don't feel good. It was like a moment on my lips, you know, forever on my hips kind of an idea. Like, why did I do that? And so I think that what I encourage people to do is trust your intuition on these things. You know, for first go through the hard part, which is adjusting to a different lifestyle. And I do think it's a lifestyle. And then it's more of an 80-20 or a 90-10 kind of a thing, because I think a lot what people don't realize about the detox pathways. And I'm no expert in this, but I've been doing this for 21 years and I've done thousands and thousands of cases. So, you know, anecdotally speaking, you know, what I find is that the people who, you know, this genetics are not hardwired, right? We know these are malleable switches. And so like the epigenetics part here should not be overlooked. When people say, oh, I've got this mutation, I've got my detox path, I don't detox well. Well, you may have made up your mind about that, but your body hasn't. And so there are things that you can and should do. And one of the best ways to do it is stop toxing. The first step in detoxing is to stop toxing.
Yes. You know, 100%.
You know, the body is like an amazing juggler. It can maintain these incredible processes with beauty and elegance and thousands of processes all at once. And mold is like a guy across the room throwing baseballs at him. You know, like, he's going to have to make a decision here. Am I going to keep juggling these processes, or am I going to defend myself from this evolutionary threat, which is what mold is? And I'm here to tell you that that's what mold does. The juggler will drop a lot of balls to protect itself from this very, very acute, serious threat. And then it sometimes has a hard time getting those balls back up and processing efficiently. So you have to give it time to allow those pathways that may be opened up with the help of a practitioner. But sometimes, oftentimes, I've seen people who just do the right thing on the detox, on the stop toxing part, right? Just stop the threat, right? Stop overloading it with air and food exposures. And then suddenly symptoms start abating. And then next thing you know, they test and they find that they've got lots of mycotoxins in their urine. And guess what that means? You're excreting them. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. If you've changed your diet and your building is clean and you're actually excreting, you actually have higher panels, that's actually a good indication, right? Some people will test and have low panels and they'll find that they're still feeling lousy. And it's because they're not excreting. And then they go through the process of actually stopping the toxification process, right? Cleaning up their diet and their building. And they're excreting more and they panic. I must have had an exposure. No, you're finally releasing these things, right? So there's a lot of counterintuitive perspective on this that needs to be maintained. And unfortunately, this often comes from the practitioners too, the panic when they see a high panel, you know?
Yeah, sometimes they're not reading it correctly. And this is something we see all the time with heavy metals too, especially looking at things in, say, like a hair test. You know, we don't see a lot. We start to detox. We see mercury come out. I always tell people that's good. That means you had it all along. It's just coming out. You didn't just happen to get mercury in the last 3 months out of nowhere, you know?
Same kind of thing. So really, it is a matter of, I think, sometimes allowing, having a little bit of patience, which is hard in our society. We all want a pill, a potion, or a powder that's going to immediately, you know, fix this thing. And my experience has been that a little bit of patience goes a long way. Getting this stuff cleaned up, getting your external exposures cleaned up, and then allowing your body to do this thing and loving your liver and, you know, like drinking clean water and sweating and, you know, all of those things, getting plenty of sunlight and, you know, supplementing where appropriate for the basic things, the important stuff, the vitamin D and, you know, the stuff that the micronutrients, and getting those things in place and maintaining those things in place will give your body permission to do what it normally does really, really well. Right. And oftentimes you don't need a protocol. You don't need a push. But for the people who don't get better after they've done that for a while, 30, 60, 90 days, then, you know, lean into maybe getting a little bit of help and getting a little bit of a push. But I really do think that most of the time this stuff does take care of itself if you take care of the basic parts, which are within your control.
And that makes so much sense on the diet front of things and the mycotoxins in food. What about the environment, right? The house, the school, the office building, because there's so much confusion here. And you already mentioned in terms of the Hermes test showing things being high when they aren't really high. So one of the things I know you talk about is that mold is really a moisture problem. So can you talk a little bit more about that and how someone could maybe think about if maybe they have exposure in their environment in addition to everything that's going on with their diet?
Sure. Yeah. So mold is always a mold problem is always a moisture problem. Always. The spores that mold produce are like the microscopic seeds that are the basis for all growth, but they will remain as spores indefinitely until the right conditions are present that allow the growth to occur. So at the end of the day, mold control is about moisture control. Now, buildings, by definition, fail in one of two ways. They fail to shed wind or water, and oftentimes both at the same time. So there's a constant onslaught by nature to basically get elements into our buildings. And so they inevitably, because of maintenance issues or natural disasters and things like that, water gets in. And then also we also generate moisture within our building through, cleaning and bathing and breathing and all that stuff. And if that moisture isn't controlled well through exhaust vents and dehumidification and things like that, it will manifest as a mold problem. So there's lots of different ways that mold can develop in a building. It's not just always from a leak or a flood. So the key is that when people ask me what the best mold test is, and we sell a mold test, of course, but I always say that you're the best mold test. You are an exquisite integrated array of precision sensors. That's what the human body is. And so learning to tune in, like I said earlier about the food, learning to tune in to your own innate sense of what's right and wrong, and learning to trust that is a big step towards being able to live in a healthy way in modern buildings. And so if you see something, meaning looking for moisture issues, any signs of dampness, so blistering paint, stains, discoloration, trim pulling away from walls, things like that, you may have a problem. If you smell something, the musty smell is often the first clue, but it's also a health hazard. Recent animal studies have shown that the musty smell is actually neurotoxic. And what that means, and by the way, all molds produce the musty smell during active growth, which means that all mold growth of significance can lead to toxicity, regardless of whether or not it produces mycotoxins. This is a very important point. Animal studies show that the fruit flies, in fact, stop producing dopamine. They start flying down instead of to the light. They develop Parkinsonian-like symptoms, locomotor dysfunction, and mitochondrial damage. And so that's exposure to one of the compounds commonly found in actively growing mold. So the musty smell is a big deal, and it's the like I said, it's often the first clue. So if you smell that musty smell, run towards that. Find the moisture source and fix that. That's the first step. So if you see something, smell something, or feel something, rather, the feel something is really important. So if you feel something, that means that in particular, a symptom that seems to get better when you leave the building. This is a really common thing where, and also, unfortunately, by the way, a lot of people don't leave the building because they feel so lousy and they're staying in the very thing that makes them sick. So it's this negative loop, but oftentimes it's a good test to go somewhere for a week. Now everybody feels better when they're on vacation, but it's often really helpful to get a little bit of space from your building. And even if that means just an afternoon walk, a lot of times people will feel that their brain fog will lift. Their energy will get better. And it can be oftentimes in a matter of hours. Usually a couple of days is a better measure. And obviously a week or longer will give you some time to really process these things. Just like with other with intoxicants, and you have to think about the mold VOCs as well as VOCs from the man-made materials, like the ones that our buildings are made of. VOCs are volatile organic compounds. And many of them are carcinogenic and have other very serious ramifications. But, one of the most popular VOCs is alcohol. So when you think about how long it takes you to feel better after you've had a night out that maybe, went a little bit longer than you might have planned, that takes a few days, right? Really for you to completely get straight. It's not the next day. It's really 2-3 days before you're actually clear again. And so when we're talking about VOCs through inhalation, it's no different. Your body still needs a few days to process these things. And the primary exposure when it comes to mold growth is the actual musty smell, because it disseminates into the air, unlike the spores and the mycotoxins, which are not distributed in the air evenly. The VOCs can be much more evenly distributed, which means that your exposure to them in every breath is much more likely. And I should also mention, we breathe 13 to 15 times a minute, which comes out to 20,000 times a day. And we spend 90% of our time indoors, often these days post-COVID, in the same building, breathing 20,000 times a day. So unless your air is pristine, what you're really doing is you're taking 20,000 doses of an unhealthy substrate, right? And so getting this clean is of the utmost importance, not just for autoimmune disease, but I would say for general health and longevity.
So let's talk about how to get that clean. So first, how do we find out if there's anything there? So you said, okay, if there's a musty smell, you know there's an issue. So in terms of mold tests out there, and I know they vary, and which is why I'm so excited about your test because of all of the benefits that it has, which I will let you talk about in a second. But if someone smells the musty smell, does it mean that they shouldn't even bother with the test, or is it still helpful to do the test? And then the second part of this question is, if there's no musty smell, but maybe they see peeling paint or bubbling paint and things that you mentioned, and you know, it doesn't smell, or maybe sometimes people just don't have a very sensitive nose. That happens often too. So then how do they test? What's the best way to see if it's an issue?
Yeah. So, I mean, they're on the DIY side of things, on the at-home test kit side of things, the reason that we created our kit was because we had people calling us over. We had a lot of national press in the beginning, Good Morning America and Extreme Makeover Home Edition and stuff like that. So we had people calling us from all over the country asking if we could come inspect their house, and they were outside of our coverage area. So a lot of people asked us for a mold test kit that we could recommend. And we heard that request so often that we began looking to see if we could find something we could recommend. And we couldn't in good conscience suggest that any one of them would be worth the investment. And in particular, ERMI is a real problem, and it leads to so much panic and so much confusion. So what we did was we decided to take a professional tool known as a spore trap, which is how most professionals test the air for mold, develop a method to collect those samples without having to hire a professional, which is very cost prohibitive and oftentimes invites someone who might have a conflict of interest into your home, and oftentimes can, you know, use that data against you, so to speak, you know.
Great sphere.
Especially if they do remediation also, which is not illegal, shockingly, in most states. You can do the inspection testing, and then you can turn around and hand someone a quote for remediating the thing that you detected. So that leaves a lot of room for abuse. So we wanted to create a tool that would allow people to safely test their air without any of those concerns. And so that's what the Got Mold Test Kit is about. And so it lets you test up to 3 rooms in your home using these professional methods. What you get is a beautiful color-coded, you know, green, yellow, orange, red interpretation of the lab data, as well as the spores that were found, the types and quantities, and resources for what to do next in terms of how to find and hire a qualified inspector if you need one, and how to find and hire a qualified remediator if you need one. So the idea here is that it doesn't replace a professional inspection, because there's a lot of conditions that are present in a building that would be helpful for the diagnosis of the underlying moisture problem that cannot be detected with a test kit, right? So we equate this to a pregnancy test kit, in the sense that you wouldn't start buying baby furniture just because it says positive. The next step is you go to the doctor. So this is really a cost-effective way for people to initially screen their home for a potential mold issue. And the nice thing about it is that each sample only takes 5 minutes. So if you do 3 rooms plus the outside sample, it's 20 minutes worth of testing. And then guess what? The pump's doing all the work. All you have to do is open it up, put the cassettes on, put them back in the return mailer, and drop it in the mail.
Makes it super easy.
Super easy. Yeah. And they start at $199, includes lab fees, shipping both ways. So it's turnkey. We even send fresh brand name batteries with it, so you can test right away. So it's $199, $249, and $299 for 1, 2, and 3 room kits. And then once you have the pump, the air sampling pump, which enables the whole thing, you can then buy refills for $50 less. So it's only $149 for a 1-room kit, $199 and $249. So really affordable, cost-effective first step. It plays well with the idea that if you see something, smell something, or feel something, because sometimes you might find that there's mold. There's 2 kinds of mold growth, really. There's mold on a wall and mold in a wall. Mold in a wall, the spore counts might be normal, so our kit might show not detected. But if there's a musty smell and there's visible water damage and things like that, that's very important, because now you know that the mold is in the wall. Doesn't mean you're not going to get exposed to it, because the musty smell is really a causal factor here, right? It's a major irritant and aggravator. But it helps you characterize the nature of the mold problem. And that's the most important part is, you know, figuring out where the moisture is coming from and then to what extent you have a mold problem. And then from there, you can determine whether or not you need professional assistance. And our kit helps you narrow that down to a simpler decision. And then we also offer, in complement to the kit, we also have developed an ebook called How to Find Mold, which is really helpful for people that are early in their mold awareness journey. And it gives you inspection checklists and FAQs, and it really walks you through your home so that before you go and spend $1,000 or $2,000 for a professional inspector, you be your own inspector and collect your own samples and get to know your building a little bit more. You know, the your building is an extension of your immune system, much like an exoskin or an exoskeleton. And to ignore that is to ignore a critical part of your overall health and well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to post links in the show notes to the ebook and the test kit as well. Now, Jason, what about air purification? So let's say someone is in the process of looking at it, or maybe, you know, they're about to start to do the tests, or maybe they're even in like the middle of the remediation phase. Does it help to have a good air purifier, or is there anything else in terms of like just the way the air moves like through that could be helpful?
Yeah. So when it comes to an indoor air quality problem, no matter what kind, whether it's you know, mold or VOCs, any indoor air quality problem, there's only three things you can do. You can remove the source. And that's not always possible or practical when you're dealing with like VOCs. If it's from like a newly finished hardwood floor, what are you going to do? Right. Or a mold problem that's maybe a little too much right now for the budget to fully remediate. Right. You may have to, or maybe you're renting and you don't even have the ability to do anything about it. So in those cases, source control is not possible. The other thing you can do is you can filter the air. And filtering the air, the key is you have to have the right kind of filter, because most indoor air quality problems come not just as particles, which is what HEPA filters remove, but also as gases like the VOCs. And so HEPA filters only take out particles and the gases pass right through. So you need a carbon element, or you need a carbon filter within the air cleaner to be able to capture those gases. That's unfortunately a weakness in most air cleaning units. Even the ones that have carbon have too little. So they get saturated fairly quickly.
Is there one you recommend?
Yeah, you know, I go back and forth on this quite a bit. On the high end, okay, there's a company called IQ Air that makes a really great unit. It's called the Health Pro Plus. And I often hesitate to recommend them because the company has changed so much recently, but the filter is great. So that they're about $1,000. Austin Air also makes really great units that have a lot of carbon in them. Lower end, I recommend.
Austin Air is the Health Mate, right?
Yes, and they've got a lot of carbon in it, and that's key. You know, on the lower end, in terms of price, Medify Air has some nice units. They don't have that much carbon in them, so you have to replace the filters pretty often. But they're much more affordable. I mean, they have one unit that's like $80 that can handle a one bedroom apartment really nicely.
Wow, right?
For the bedroom.
That's great to know.
But you have to replace the filters, so you have to consider that as part of the overall expense, because if you're not replacing the filters, you might as well not have one. So the VOCs, HEPA filters still work even if they're not replaced. They just wear out the motor a little bit because they kind of get bucked. The filter gets a little bit clogged. But the VOC filters, if they get saturated, air still passes through them, but the VOCs do too. So
for VOCs, that is the carbon filter, right? And how often would a carbon filter need to be replaced, in your opinion?
You know, it depends on what the VOC load is in the building, unfortunately. Now, IQ Air has a really cool feature where when you replace the VOC filter, you'll see it has little red beads inside mixed in with the black carbon. And if you check periodically, you'll see that when they get black, they've actually gotten saturated. So they have a visual indicator. Otherwise, a lot of them just have this sort of like this silly thing that is like, if it's run for a certain number of hours, you should change it, or a certain number of months. And that's not an accurate representation of exposure to or of saturation. So I would say in most cases, if you've got, you know, something that's got a little bit of carbon in it, probably every 3 months or less even. So it really depends on the VOC load. Now, the other thing is, it's hard to test for the VOCs. There's a company called Enthalpy Labs. They have a product called Home Air Check. I don't know if they sell direct to consumer, but they do a VOC test. And if you can I can find out and possibly send you a link for your show notes for that as well, because that would be helpful. Knowing how much you have of something is helpful to determine how much you need to invest in removing it.
And is it correct to say that mold, in addition to mycotoxins, also produces VOC? So the VOCs are coming from the mold.
Yes.
In addition, right, to potentially the hardwood floors and furniture and carpets and whatever else.
Yeah. So the VOC, volatile organic compounds, and then there's microbial volatile organic compounds, which is the musty smell. So really, when you look at air quality, you have to look at the VOCs that come from microbial sources as well as from man-made sources. So we just covered the source control. Removal, remediation, that's one thing you can do. The second thing you can do is air filtration. The third thing you can do, and this is the only three things you can do when it comes to an air quality problem. The third thing is ventilation or dilution, which is to bring fresh air in from somewhere else. Now, it can be as simple as opening your windows. Now, assuming it's not too hot, too cold, or too humid outside, that works well. But you know, the same reason why opening your you can't necessarily use your window in your bathroom as a bathroom exhaust vent, right? Because seasonally speaking, that's not a very efficient way to do it. So you have to use a fan. Well, they have energy recovery ventilators and heat recovery ventilators, these air exchange units that you can put into a building. They're becoming more common, and they should be in every building because it purges, it sends out the stale air and it brings in fresh air, and it exchanges through something called a heat exchanger. It exchanges the heat that from the building or the air conditioning energy into the new air, so that you're not just, you know, sending out your heated and cooled air.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's actually something we're looking to get for our basement, to do like a air exchange and a heat exchange too.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very useful tool. I think every building should have them, especially modern buildings, because we build these buildings out of chemical products. You know, our building material companies are chemical companies. Make no mistake, just like our food and our pharma companies are. So this is one of the problems we face now as a society, is that we need to be educated about this stuff. And when possible, choose VOC-free products. And the good news is that the demand has actually led to industry creating them. So ask around for that stuff. If you're doing a renovation, do not take builder-grade materials. Always ask the contractor for VOC-free products. Go to greenguard.org. It's a great resource for VOC healthy products. But then a lot of times we've already bought the building. We're already living in it. You're not gonna remove the paint from your walls or the finish from your floors. So these energy recovery ventilators allow you to mechanically dilute as those materials off gas over time. Otherwise, what happens is they build up and accumulate indoors as we sit here and breathe 20,000 times a day. And then we wonder why we've got skyrocketing rates of asthma, allergies, autoimmune disease, not to mention cancer and autism and things like that. And so these are things that we didn't have to worry about when our buildings breathed. So when we had lots of natural ventilation in our buildings, and we built with natural chemically inert materials like plaster, brick, stone, old growth timber, we've gone way off when it comes to the quality of the materials. And then we also tighten up our buildings for energy efficiency all at the same time. And it's really kind of like the proverbial boiling frog, you know?
Yeah, for sure. But it's so helpful for people to know that there are things that they can do, because I think so often when people hear mold, at least I know for me in the past, it was like mold equals, I don't even know what to do. And then for so many people, they're like, well, I don't know what to do. So I'm just going to pretend it's not there. I'm going to do nothing. I hear that all the time. And so, you know, for people who are dealing with Hashimoto's and thyroid issues, but again, it really could be anything. And so often with Hashimoto's, we talk about triggers, mold being one of them, but then the other toxins are triggers. There's other chemicals, those other VOCs that are not microbial are also going to be triggers. So the more that we could support those triggers, the more that actually just takes the pressure off the immune system. And it helps to, as I say, unconfuse the immune system. So Jason, this has been so helpful for people to really understand that it's not just, oh my gosh, you need to like knock your house down, right? Because sometimes people are told that you have mold, literally throw everything out, right? It's like, let's not go there, but it's like, let's look at the food, let's look and see how we can properly remediate and what actually needs to be remediated. And then like you said, let's ventilate and let's really help that air, because there are things that you could do in the meantime too. So it's been so, so helpful. Jason, for people who want to connect with you, how do they contact you? How can they find out more about the test kit? Because I think it's such a wonderful, easy, at home, inexpensive option where they could get started and then see. And then I love that you also guide people from that of what to do, and providers that are, you know, are going to be safe, that are going to be effective. They're going to be in the know about this.
Yes, thank you for that. And so what we did to make this easy for your listeners is we created a welcome page, which you can find at gotmold.com/mysteries solved. That's plural, mysteries solved.
Yep, we'll post that.
On that page, you can find a coupon code, which is mysteries10, which allows any of your listeners to get a 10% discount on any of our test kits. And what you'll also find there is a link to the ebook that I mentioned earlier. So it's all in one place. And then from there, you also have access to our contact form, which is a great way to lob any questions at us that you may have. So I don't answer all of them, but I do see all of them. And the other place for people to contact us and to ask questions would be on social, specifically on Instagram and on Facebook. So you can go in. We actually have a pinned post on Instagram, which is ask Jason anything. And so you can go there and ask questions. And I generally get to those pretty quickly.
Wonderful. Well, Jason, thank you so much for being here and for all of this information. And I'm excited for people to explore this a little bit more and for them not to be scared and stressed, but actually have things, actionable things that they can do. So thank you so much. And I look forward to connecting with you again soon.
Thanks for having me.
As you just heard, mold can be a real problem with so many health ailments, and it could be such a trigger with Hashimoto's and thyroid issues. To really address it, we have to do it in a multifaceted way. First, Bonnie tested her house. And as Jason mentioned, not all test kits are created equal. When the test came back showing that there was an issue, she got a crew in to properly clean and fix the underlying moisture issue and then properly ventilate, which made a huge difference. While her house was being supported, we worked on her body. We started with really cleaning up her diet, and then we used a protocol that included binders, glutathione, and antifungal agents. Between the clean air and the binders and detox, Bonnie's energy and brain fog started to improve. 3 months into the process, she felt like a new person. She almost forgot what it was like not to be able to remember anything like she was feeling before. She was so out of it, and now she was feeling so much better and so much sharper and so much more productive. Bonnie was so excited, and of course, so was I. If Bonnie sounds like someone you know, or you know someone that may suspect a mold issue, please share this episode with them. And please be sure that you're subscribed to the show so that you never miss another thyroid mystery. As always, when it comes to health issues, please, please do not give up. The answers are out there and there is hope. I'm Ina Toppler. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Thyroid Mystery Solved, Hashimoto's and Hypothyroidism Revealed, and I will see you on the next one.
All information, content, and material on this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to serve as a substitute for the consultation, diagnosis, and/or medical treatment of a qualified physician or healthcare provider.